Underworld. Disc 13.
When Esther gave advice, and Clara submitted to it, there should have been an element of reciprocal condescension. Because Esther was usually overbearing, and Clara a little offhand and glib. But in fact, she needed to hear whatever Esther had to say. Esther said a number of useless things. But she needed to know someone was out there preparing a space, making time for her, and uttering her name, and passing on stray accolades from whatever shadowy source. It didn't always help. When Clara heard praise, it sounded weak and tentative to her, badly rehearsed. And when she was criticized in the press or through the intimate roundabouts of rumor and half-news, she had to struggle against the feeling that they might be right. She was doing shallow and meek and dismissible work. "This is the Darwin dog-eat-dog," Esther liked to say, said incessantly, enjoyed saying, because she knew it scared people like Clara. She loved the floorboards stacked in the corner, streaked brown wood, sort of drenchingly dark brown, like the staved towers on the rooftops, the tanks filled with water, and mostly bare to the elements, but sometimes enclosed in elaborate churchly structures with lancet arches and great eagled ornamentation. People weren't saying, "Oh, wow," anymore. They were saying, "No way," instead. And she wondered if there was something she might learn from this. She watched her friend, A.C. Green, on TV. A new friend, young and talented, interviewed late at night on a local cable outlet. She looked great. "You look so great," Clara thought, modestly afroed in a torn dinner jacket and red bow tie. Miles called, and she met him at an old sailmaking loft downtown. The film group he belonged to showed rare things, mostly unrunnable in theaters for one reason or another, and the screenings were a floating affair, wherever Miles could secure a space. 50 or 60 people were here to see a Robert Frank film, Cocksucker Blues, about the Rolling Stones on tour in America. Clara sat in the dark and spooned yogurt from a carton. She realized she'd been seeing Mick Jagger's mouth everywhere she went for some time now. Maybe it was the corporate logo of the Western world, the leer and pout that follows you down the street. She liked to watch him dance and devil strut, but found the mouth a separate object, sort of added later for effect. She told AC, who sat next to her, she said, "I think everything that everybody's eaten in the last 10 years has gone into that mouth." She loved the wash blue light of the film, a kind of crepuscular light, a tunnel light that suggested an unreliable reality. Not unreliable at all, in fact, because you have no trouble believing what you see, but a subversive reality, maybe. Corruptive and ruinous, a beautiful tunnel blue.
"You have to interpret the mouth like it's satire," AC said.
Coke-sniffing backstage, or in the tunnels, and people sitting around a room, or sleeping on a plane, that edge-of-time feeling, remarks half-uttered, a cigarette in someone's mouth, people not yet ready to stir. And she liked the glancing sound, the way documentaries sound, this kind of fly-by movie, bounces off the tile walls, the cinder-block walls in dressing rooms and stadium tunnels. Someone saying, "Often he will shoot me in an unfavorable way." And she realized, yes, his mouth was completely satirical. It was caricaturish, a form of talking anus from the counter-comics of the 60s. And all the jeers and taunts we'd uttered, all the half-sentences we'd mumbled, had come out of the same body opening, more or less. AC said, "I saw them in San Francisco. This is the same tour, has to be. 2 years ago this was." Throwing the hotel TV off a balcony. Interviews mumbled and blotted, the simplest of earnest, rehearsed queries lost and pondered and lost again. The tour is a series of unfinished remarks, and a man and a woman fucking on the plane, and the mouth-chewing food, the paste-on, peel-off mouth, Mick strobed and flashed in concert like some multi-mouth de Kooning female sucking on the hand mic. The camera phalanx in the tunnels, people sitting around, two people asleep in a lump, or tripped out, or they could be unnoticeably dead. The endless, noisy boredom of the tour, tunnels and runways. AC said, I went to the show and there's this bodyguard. Maybe I can spot him in one of these shots. A black guy with a t-shirt that says Stones, you know, security. Only something else completely, but along those similar lines. And Clara loved the tunnel blue light and the nothing happening parts. Everybody's got cameras and they're shooting nothing happening. And the sound that gets lost in the ceiling tiles. Someone saying, I hate those motherfuckers, those in-between schmucks. Saying, what state are we in? Two mumbling junkies on a bed, a man and woman equally sort of squintingly attentive to the needle that's angled in her arm. Saying, how come you wanted to film that? Saying, it hadn't occurred to me to film that. Oh, Indiana, it just happened. Mick standing slack-jawed in room, the mouth gargling and spitting, licking ice cream cone, and the concert footage that's gelled red, bodies bioluminescent. What we all love about rock, Clara thought, the backlit nimbus of higher dying. Excedrin on TV, significantly more effective than common aspirin. And he's following me, AC said, down this long tunnel, and he's saying, Brown Sugar, you wait for me because there's something I got here which I definitely want you to look at. Hey, Brown Sugar. And I turned, which was admittedly, you know, completely dumbass. And he didn't have it out, but he had his hand on it. Two white men in room and one white man talking in black voice about put the brothers in touch with their cultural heritage. And second white man threads needle into arm. And first white man talking black says, Tomb of the Unknown Junkie. 137th Street and Lenox Avenue, made top to bottom, he says, from discarded spikes. Someone saying, they took my child away from me because I was on acid. Where's my room key? Tunnels and runways and washed blue light, and then the opening to the stage, the loud white glare and prehistoric roar. You suck him off? Nah, I just took a picture with him. Saying, the state comes along and takes my kid from me. A nude woman, caressing herself on bed in hotel room, who rubs hand on pussy, then licks it. And AC interrupting her story to say, The whole jerk-off, monotonic, airborne eroticon. And Clara thought it was interesting that this was the only woman who didn't seem like a girl. It was interesting, she thought, how all the women in the film were girls or became girls. The men and women did all the same things, dope, sex, picture-taking. But the men stay men, and the women become girls. Except maybe the woman who rubs her pussy and licks it and says something inaudible, because the whole point of sound in a film like this is to lose it in the corners of the room. I don't care. It's only San Diego. AC was telling her story, and meanwhile looking for the guy in the story up there on the screen. And I wanted to say something to, you know, disabuse him of every wishful thought in his head. Hey, Brown Sugar. But we're alone in this big, roaring, echoing place. The concert's in full roar somewhere above us, and Brown Sugar, he's, Brown Sugar, Brown Sugar. The show we're looking at now? Clara said. I don't know if it's the same night, but it's the same show, the same city, the same motherfucking band of emaciated millionaire pricks and their Negro bodyguards. It was the rooftop summer, and the air was filled with heroes, the dusty sky that burned with stormlight. Oblong gods braced in narrow corners, and a pair of seated pharaohs that flank an air conditioner. And she loved the mermaided columns she saw on Lower Fifth, and all the oddnesses, the enigmatic figures she couldn't place in particular myth, mainly downtown, atop the older banks, on the parapets and setbacks. Robed oracles jutting over the streets, or helmeted men of unrevealing aspect. Lawgivers or warriors, it was hard to tell. And it was down there on a roof one Sunday, the streets hot and dead, that the gentleman reappeared. The European she'd talked to once before, gazing into the unfinished grid of the World Trade Center. "Yes, hello. We meet again." And he told her that the figures she'd been wondering about with their cultic look, faces in shadow under the streamlined headgear, were called the Titans of Finance. And how suitably dour they were, as if measuring the Depression's effects on the streets below. She guessed the building had been erected around that time.
"Some kind of secret fraternal order, sounds like to me."
"Perhaps," he said. "But all banking is secret, I think." And she could believe it, with all the granite and limestone massed around them, and the newer towers, curtained sheer, of reflecting glass and anodized aluminum, and every office empty of human trace today, except in basements, maybe, where paper was spun through microfilm machines, 1 billion checks a second. His name was Carlos Strasser. He lived on Park Avenue and collected art with an amateur's clumsy passion, he said. An apartment on Park and an old farmhouse near Arles, where he went to do his thinking. And of course, she said, "What do you think about?" And he said, "Money." She laughed. "I sometimes wonder what money is," she said. "Yes, of course, exactly. This is the question. I'll tell you what I think. It is becoming very esoteric. All waves and codes. A higher kind of intelligence. Travels at the speed of light." He was dressed very well. He was turned out. He had presence and manner, and she felt a little shambly, but not uncomfortably so, in her denim and old sandals. The man confirmed her in her partialities, and she was marvelously, in fact, at ease talking to him. They heard foghorns in the bay and paused to listen, and the sound had an element of formal awe. It rolled and caromed down the narrow streets, collided with itself, an organ work that swelled the air and sent pigeons beating out of the tower clocks. He asked questions about painters, and she did something she almost never did. She expounded. She did detailed analysis, a thing she had tended to avoid even when she used to teach. She heard herself go into explanations so ardent and newly struck that she realized she'd been withholding them from herself. "Louise told me once, Nevelson, that she looked at a canvas or a piece of wood, and it was white and pure and virginal. And no matter how much she marked it up, how many strokes and colors and images, the whole point was to return it to its virgin state. And this was the great and frightening thing." Clara couldn't connect this remark to her own work, but she liked to repeat it to herself anyway. She liked the idea of a famous artist being frightened by what she does. "I have a small Nevelson," he said. "Very small piece. I bought it years ago. And now you have given me a reason to look at it in a different way. And this is something I will do, with pleasure." "I'd go into her studio, and she'd show me a black sculpture, a wood sculpture painted black, and I'd comment on the color, and I'd comment on the material. And she'd look at the thing, and she'd say, 'But it's not black, and it's not wood.' She thinks reality is shallow and weak and fleeting, and we're very different in that regard." Miles showed up later, and Carlos Strasser faded gracefully into the cluster. 8 or 9 people standing around a table filled with cheese and fruit and wine, those lion blood Bordeaux, those damson plums and blue-black nights, and how the thunder sounded dry and false. Standing in someone's kitchen, slicing a lemon, she understood that the knife would slip and she would cut herself. And she did. It was one of those microseconds that's long and slow and nuclear-packed with information, and she knew it would happen, and kept on slicing. And then it happened. She cut her finger and watched the blood edge out from the knife line and slide unevenly down her knuckle. She watched people sunbathing. They did it so completely, dominating the experience. A woman flopped on a ledge with a blanket and a pitcher of iced tea, and a child's drinking glass appliqued with flowers, and a paperback book that Clara tried to spy the title of. They did it without conceding anything to the stone ledges or pitched roofs or breathless tar surfaces. It was the spectacle of here I am. And there's a window washer's empty rig scaling the side of a slab tower. She saw a brick facade flushed with coral light, more or less on fire with light. And the brick seemed revealed the way only light reveals a thing. It is baked clay of some intenser beauty than she'd ever thought to notice. And there's the old lady again, sitting in her web chair with the Sunday papers scattered, so familiar and encouraging. She holds a reflector under her chin and faces sacrificially into the sun, a plattered head going mummy brown in the deeps of a summer day. She watched the blood slide out from the cut and noticed the creases and whorls in her finger, and heard the music in the next room. It's Esther's husband, Jack, playing one of his old 45s, the swing band music that drives his guests out onto the roof. The garbage was down there, stacked in identical black plastic bags, and she walked home past a broad mound that covered a fire hydrant and part of a bus sign, and she saw how everyone agreed together not to notice. Miles Lightman showed up late for dinner on a roof uptown, carrying a box of the black cigarettes she smoked, queen-sized and extra mild and slow-burning, and a baggie of marijuana, which he liked to call boo, a term he'd heard in some bar in Harlem maybe 20 years ago. They were on the roof of a new building, 40 stories. It loomed over the reservoir in the park, and they stood a while watching runners in the night. The runners went around the reservoir in fair numbers, faintly lamplit, and Miles thought they resembled fleeing crowds in a Japanese horror film. He had a thing for fleeing crowds. He wanted to do a picture book on the subject. He collected publicity stills from obscure productions, fleeing crowds of Asiatics looking up at something awesome. They stood on the roof and looked across the park to the silhouetted buildings named like ocean liners— the Beresford, Majestic, and El Dorado, the Ansonia and San Remo. Fleeing crowds always included a mother with a baby, and a woman with bulging breasts, and a man with his arms flung up to shield him from some terror in the sky. Miles looked at the runners going around the reservoir, and he came up with a name for the 40-story building that loomed over the park, so tall and massive it made its own weather. Downdrafts nearly strong enough to topple people walking by. Godzilla Towers, he thought they ought to call it. It's women, usually, who take the lead in recovering lost careers. When you begin to hear about a writer re-emergent, or a painter lovingly disinterred, it's usually because women have shown extraordinary interest. Even when the artist is a man. Usually the artist is a woman, but even a man. We specialize in forgotten lives, Clara said. She was talking to A.C. Green. A.C. didn't need to be reclaimed, of course. She was young, smart, ambitious, and so on. And interestingly, sweet mean, playing with juxtapositions as a form of ironic dialogue with herself. A device to help her confront the prospect of being famous. A.C. grew up in Chicago, where both parents were teachers, and she began to do pen and ink sketches. She began to do West Indian collages, pretty much in the tritest manner possible, according to her own account, and had a sexual adventure with a member of the Blackstone Rangers, a very sizable street gang, and eventually packed a bag and went to Los Angeles, where she married a professor of sociology and enrolled at Cal Arts, and got a divorce and found her karma as a painter. When Clara first saw her work, she told people how good it was, and word reached Acey on the coast. Eventually, she followed her paintings east. She was living at the Chelsea Hotel for the time being, and sharing studio space in Brooklyn somewhere.
"What about you?" she said.
"Me? I had to make a career before I could worry about losing it. That was not easy. I pay and pay."
"A family," AC said.
"I broke up a family, yes. I went away, I came back. I took my daughter for a while. She was better off with her father, and I understood that, but it consumed me, being separated like that. I had a very bad time. Of course, we all did. She came down to see me on weekends or whenever. He rode the subway with her and left her at the door because he didn't want to set eyes on me.
What would it do to him?
And then he came and picked her up, and I wasn't allowed to walk all the way down the stairs. I walked her down to the first floor. I was living in a ramshackle building way downtown, and it was arranged and agreed that I would walk her to the first floor and let her go the rest of the way herself, because he might otherwise set eyes on me. What would it do to him? Something, I don't know, catastrophic.
But you talked on the phone.
We talked on the phone, in monosyllables. We sounded like spies passing coded messages. It was a very hateful time. But once she was older, that stopped, the phone calls. She and I made our own arrangements. Albert was gone for good.
And her?
Teresa doesn't hate me. Maybe worse, I think she hates herself. She was part of the failure somehow. Let's not talk about this.
We'll go for a walk.
We'll walk across the bridge. Ever do that?
I'm new here, lady. You forget.
AC's best work was part of a series about the Blackstone Rangers. Chicago winters, young men in hooded sweatshirts, morose and idly violent, hunched in front of barred windows or sitting on a broken sofa in the snow. And Clara thought these pictures were utterly modern in one sense only, that the subject seemed photographed, overtly posing or caught unaware, sometimes self-consciously aloof. A housing project masked behind them. Or here's a man with lidded eyes and a watch cap and one of those bloated polyester jackets and a gun with banana clip. You see how AC belies the photographic surface by making the whole picture float ineffably on the arc of the cartridge clip. People on the roof, Esther's guests, fleeing the swing band on the record player in the apartment, and Esther's husband coming out as well, Jack, because he's the kind of man who melts away if he's left alone for 20 seconds. She loved the little temple across the street, a top-floor facade with a set of recessed windows between the fluted columns. And does someone actually live there? She felt good. She felt lucky for a change. She was sleeping well and saving money and seeing friends again. "What's she reading?" someone said, talking about the woman on the ledge with the child's drinking glass and paperback book. "Looks like detective fiction from here," Jack said. "Lots of moral rot. That's what people read in summer." He was a tall, florid guy, Jack Marshall, a Broadway press agent who was on the perennial edge of dropping dead. You know these guys. They smoke and drink heavily and never sleep and have bad tickers and cough up storms of phlegm. And the thrill of knowing them, Clara thought, is guessing when they'll pitch into their soup. She wore a bandage on her finger and waited for Miles to show up with her cigarettes, because he was more reliable than she was. She grubbed one from Jack for now. And people on the street... When did Clara begin to notice how people talked to themselves, spoke aloud? So many of them, and all of a sudden. Or made threats. Or walked along gesturing. So that the streets were taking on a late medieval texture. Which maybe meant we had to learn all over again how to live among the mad.
"You have a boo-boo, Clara."
"You can't kiss it, so go away."
"I don't want to kiss it. I want to lick it," Jack said.
Does someone live? I'm very curious about the thing across the street there.
Inside the little Greek temple? I think it's an office.
I would love to get a job there.
Import, export.
I could do either.
So could I, but I want to lick it, he said.
AC had an oval face and high forehead. Her hair had the barest cinnamon tinge. If you looked at her, if she sat across the aisle on a bus and you sneaked a glance every other stop, it was probably because of her mouth. She had a tough mouth, a smart mouth. It had a slight distortion of shape you'd probably call a sneer, although the look shifted and moderated all the time and gave her smile a windfall quality, like a piece of unexpected news.
I didn't have to leave my husband to paint, she told Clara. I had to leave him because I didn't want to be with him anymore.
What was the problem?
He's a man, AC said.
Clara noticed, mid-bridge, how the younger woman checked the human action, the bike riders and runners, and what they wear and who they are, and the thing they develop together of a certain presentational self. Not like Chicago, AC said, where the action near the lake is all unselfconscious sweat. People who are busting to run, to shake off the film of office and job, the abnormal pall of matter. Here, the film is what they're in. The scan of crisp skyline. And she seemed ready for it, AC did.
And you're here now, and maybe for good. So the sense of starting over must be doubly strong.
I probably started over a long time ago. Unbeknownst basically to everyone but me.
You worry about the consequences?
A breaking up? Had to happen. I'd worry if it hadn't.
What about the husband?
What about him?
AC said.
I don't know. What about him? Does he know you have women lovers?
He gets off on dykes. I told him, I said, James, I'll send you some action snaps, baby.
You're a gangster, Clara said.
Gangster's Mall. Gang Mall. That's what they called me in L.A., you know, the Blackstone paintings. Middle-class Negro groupie.
Very nice. They called me the Bag Lady.
They laughed and crossed to the Brooklyn side, where AC worked in an old warehouse not far from the bridge approach. She didn't want to show her current work prematurely, and they only did a tour of the space. There was a Marilyn Monroe calendar on the wall, the famous early pin-up called Miss Golden Dreams, a high-angle shot of the nude body posed on a velveteen, blood-red bedsheet.
This can't be here accidentally, can it? Okay, it's something I'm looking at,
AC said.
And thinking about?
Something I'm working out for myself, little by little by little.
Interesting. But I hear you're doing something completely different.
Oh, yeah? What do you hear?
And Clara swung an arm toward the far wall, where canvases stood on a low shelf or were bracketed on easels with some strips of construction paper she'd glimpsed earlier, paper taped to unfinished work as color mapping guides.
I hear you're doing a Black Panther series.
AC did her scornful smile, slow and elaborate.
Oh, yeah? Well, you know what? That's what I hear, too.
This was supposed to be a post-painterly age, Clara thought, and here was a young woman painting whole heat. A black woman who paints black men generously, but not without exercising a certain critical rigor. The frontal swagger of the gangs, a culture of nearly princely hauteur, but with bodings, of course, of unembellished threat. And this is what AC examined surgically, working the details, looking for traces of the solitaire, the young man isolated from his own moody pose. They walked back across the bridge.
They still call you that? The Bag Lady?
Not so much anymore, Clara said. There were a few of us then. We took junk and saved it for art, which sounds nobler than it was. It was just a way of looking at something more carefully,
And I'm still doing it. Only deeper, maybe. It's not my thing. Maybe I don't trust the need for context. You know what I mean?
I guess.
Because I understand up to a point. You take your object out of the dusty, grubby studio and stick it in a museum with white walls and classical paintings, and it becomes a forceful thing in this context. It becomes a kind of argument. And what it is, actually? Old factory window glass and burlap sacking. It becomes very, I don't know, philosophical.
They reached the other side, and AC wanted to walk some more, and Clara was nearly beat. They looked at old sailing ships moored off South Street. She was trying to dispel the little hurt, the small delayed disappointment of AC's casual slighting of her work. First, she delayed her reaction. Then she tried to smother it.
I was the type girl, AC said. I was always in a hurry to grow up. Now I guess I'm here, officially. This city is the ticking clock. Makes me panic, but I'm ready.
What Clara admired most was the seeming ease of address, the casually ravishing way AC laid down paint. Saturated undercoats and beautiful flesh browns, skin strokes in every sort of unnameable shade, and many grays as well, glaucous and sky smoke. Because it's always winter in Chicago, and the gang members belong to their terrain, to the pale brick and iced-over windows. And in this sense, they could be brothers to the olive-skinned men in the frescoed gloom of some Umbrian church. AC had the calm and somber eye of a Cinquecentist. She was talking on the phone to Esther Winship. Esther said,
"Dear God, why?"
"Because it's easier and quicker."
"But I haven't been on a subway in 30 years.
"Good. I want to feel superior."
They took the Dyer Avenue line. The train was marked with graffiti outside and in, slapdash and depressing, Clara thought. She didn't like the idea of tagging trains. It was the romance of the ego, poor kids playing out a fantasy of meretricious fame.
"I thought it would be stifling hot," Esther said. "I thought I'd suffocate in my seat."
She said this in a grim whisper, afraid that someone might overhear and take offense somehow. In the subway, words have a charged quality they don't carry elsewhere.
"It's called air conditioning," Clara whispered back.
"I'm completely stunned."
Esther liked to sound stupidly out of touch. It sealed her in a safer frame of reference. Two stops into the Bronx, their train took on passengers, and another train pulled into the downtown side, and Clara felt a poke in the ribs. It was Esther, thrusting an elbow to get her attention, because the other train was one of his. Moonman's. Every car spray-painted top to bottom with his name and street number. And Clara had to admit this particular kid knew how to make an impact. The train came bopping into the old drab station like some blazoned jungle of wonders. The letters and numbers fairly exploded in your face, and they had a relationship. They were plated and knotted, pop-eyed cartoon humanoids winding in and out of each other, and sweaty hot and passion dancing, metallic silver and blue and cherry bomb red, and a number of neon greens. Esther whispering out of her clenched jaw, "That's him! That's him! That's him!" That was his train, all right. But they never found the young man himself. They looked for the address Esther had acquired from a reporter who'd done a story on graffiti writers. Moonman hadn't told the guy what his real name was or where he lived, only his age, 16. The address came from another kid, who claimed to be in Moonman's crew, and the two women searched it out. Walking across a terrain of torched buildings, whole blocks leveled by arson. And there were buildings still burning in the distance. They stopped and watched. 3 or 4 buildings oozing lazy smoke. No sign of fire engines or anxious people grouped behind barricades. Just a few passers-by, it seemed from here, routinely occupied. They watched in silence, and it was hard to bridge the distance. They couldn't quite place the thing in context. It was like a newsreel of some factional war in a remote province, where generals cook the livers of their rivals and keep them in plastic baggies. A thing totally spooked by otherness. Esther finally spoke.
This is where you used to live?
No, I lived about a mile north of here.
Still, I have to show you more respect.
Thank you, Esther. But it wasn't like this at the time.
Still, I have to make an effort to be nicer to you.
You do that, Clara said.
They knew it wasn't a good idea to stand around indefinitely, and when they reached 157th Street and looked for the young man's address, they found there was no such number. They went into a couple of bodegas and asked at a check-cashing place. People said,
Mooney? Who's Mooney?
They said, what kind of Mormon? There's no Mormons here. And the women said,
no, 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 Moon Man. Moon Man 157.
And they made spray paint gestures and said,
graffiti, graffiti.
And Esther wore a safari jacket, like some network correspondent looking for rebels in the Smoky Hills. And who could blame her, really?
You look a little Chinese tonight,
Miles said.
Jason used to call me the chink.
She said this in her small voice. She looked and sounded small to herself. People were getting bigger, she was getting smaller, going more or less invisible. If Miles weren't here, how long would it take the waiter to wait on her?
Jason. I know a Jason.
Jason, my second husband. Jason Vanover.
They were eating seafood on Mulberry Street, in a place Miles liked to come to, because a mobster had been killed here, shot in the head by a couple of guys from a rival family. Or his own family, maybe. Or a family from out of town.
You're always mentioning people that I don't know and that I never heard of, and you mention them, he said, in a way that makes me think I'm supposed to know who you're talking about, when, as a matter of fact, I couldn't, possibly.
It's true, I do that.
People go by me in a blur.
It's just that I feel if I know someone, it's automatic that the person I'm talking to about that individual should also know him, by some human arithmetic, she said.
Miles had a cold. He always had a cold. It went unnoticed, went without saying. He had coughing jags and slightly woozy eyes, completely unremarked by people who knew him. It was part of the irregular life, the general unhealth, half meals and travel and erratic sleep. He looked around for particular silhouettes, hefty men in suits who might be connected.
I used to look more Chinese when my hair was shorter, she said.
What did he do?
He was a market analyst, a risk taker with his own and other people's money, and a sailor. We used to sail for weeks at a time. A yachtsman. That was the best thing about our marriage. When we shared the catch, everything fell into place. He had a catch he named High Finance.
You on a boat?
We knew we had to cooperate. We had to live in close quarters, take turns at the wheel, in the galley, share the head, stow the equipment, coil the lines, keep things in their place.
Yes, me on a boat.
We were disciplined. We respected the boat and the elements.
We had a pretty good marriage, as long as we were aboard.
They walked over to the loft. A supermarket cart stood in the middle of the street, and cars went around it, and a man rose from the shadow of a loading platform, murmuring a plea to Jesus. They shared a joint and watched a news clip of Nixon waving on TV.
AC told me she was at a party, and she said to a man, what do men really want from women? And he said, blowjobs. And she said, you can get that from men.
In 6 months, AC will be too famous to live, Miles said. She'll be assassinated walking out of a disco.
It wasn't quite time for her to go back to work, but it was beginning to be the time. Something in her skin began its anxious leap. Some need to handle and shape. Only deeper, really. some need so whole, she could sit alone in the loft and be a little wary of it. "Yes, walking out of a disco," she said. "And then you'll want to take me dancing there." Her mother took her downtown. Her and Rochelle, her best friend, and they ate lunch at the Automat near Times Square, where the front window was stained glass and the milk came out of the mouth of a bronzed fish. They watched matinee crowds enter theaters, and her mother made comments on the ladies' hats. They looked in shop windows of the better sort. Her mother took them into fine hotels and office buildings, marched them right in, and showed them the moldings and engravings in the lobbies, the carved wood on elevator doors. And they stood outside a skyscraper on Fifth Avenue. It was probably 1934, and the Japanese were entrenched in Manchuria. And they looked straight up the face of the building and walked through the polished lobby, and it was the Fred F. French building. Which intrigued the girls, because who on earth was Fred F. French? And Clara's mother, who knew things, who worked for a social service agency and studied child psychology, who followed world events and worried about China, who planned these outings systematically, did not have a clue to the identity of Fred F. French. And this intrigued the girls even more, intrigued and amused them. They were 13 and 14, and everything amused them. They rode home on the 3rd Avenue L, rattle-banging up Manhattan and through the Bronx, looking out the train windows into tenement apartments on both sides, hundreds of film-flickering lives shooting past their eyes 40 feet above the street. And Rochelle might see an undershirted man leaning tousled out his window, and "Maybe that's Fred F. French," she'd say. "He's had a streak of bad luck. Ha ha." And that was the end of that, Clara said to Miles. They were in bed playing cards in the loft. Until 3 or 4 years later, when the girls left a high school dance with two boys who weren't even in their high school, interlopers from the north, and the four of them slipped into somebody's parked car at the dark end of the street, and they puffed a couple of cigarettes and talked and smooched and necked and petted. Clara and one boy were huddled in the front seat, and Rochelle had the other boy in the roomy rear. Boy-crazy Rochelle, putting on a show of tonguing and seat-slithering, actually raising dust from the upholstery. And she wore a smoky look that distracted the front seat partners and made them stop and watch. There was just enough light to watch, and it went on toward the outer limits of what a girl is willing to commit herself to, even a boy-crazy minx like Rochelle. The boy in the back seat was in a bundled frenzy by now, and Rochelle's look contained a complicated betrayal. It was smoky and deadly and cool, and it seemed to be saying to Clara that their friendship, the best and deepest there could ever be, was about to enter a strange and disturbing phase, the intricate thing of men and sex and personal needs. There was a flurry of hands and knees. There was all that stuff of back seats and body angles and what you're wearing, the whole grabby flare-up of sex in the dark. She heard panty-band elastic snapping. She thought she heard the boy's finger actually enter the fleshy pocket between Rochelle's legs, a palpatory sea-suck, the wetness, the slaver of long, stupefying kisses, that whole thing of having a strand of his hair in your mouth that you can't exactly locate. And it was abruptly and bitterly clear that Rochelle had done this before, gone this far and more. And what a shock to Clara, detecting such experience in her best friend's eyes. And she watched in a clinical spell. She looked and listened. What a stark thing a secret is when it belongs to someone else. Now she knew what people meant by experience, the way they use the word experience, and the form it took was not sex, but knowledge, and the knowledge was not hers, but her friend's. How it twisted her insides and made her feel puppyish and dumb. She heard Rochelle mutter something like, "Time to take the rubber out of your wallet, Bob." Or she might have said Rob. But instead of a pale, flexible sheath, the boy took out his living thing, stiff and pulsing and ultraviolet. There it was, suddenly unbuttoned, and in the world. Pretty much the configuration Clara had imagined, but so hot and real, independently alive, unyoked to the host, to the bearer, the wearer. And Rochelle was nervous because the boy didn't have a rubber. And Clara was nervous because the Japanese might invade China. Miles cut the cards and listened. And at the all-crucial moment, Rochelle Abramowitz looked over the boy's shoulder into the eyes of Clara Sachs and said to her, thoughtfully, "What do you think the F stands for?" And Clara said, "What F?" And Rochelle said, "The F in Fred F. French." This was a good thing to say. Maybe it was the best thing anyone had ever said, then or now, under the circumstances. And it made them friends again. They dissolved, as the saying goes, in laughter. They practically disappeared into their constituent elements, into atoms and molecules, a couple of girls and a gangster Packard, blown forward in time. And Clara stood on the roof, sipping tepid wine, and hearing people say, "We need theater." And she knew she would tell this story to Miles. And she also knew she could never again have a friend like Rochelle, or a mother like her mother, for that matter. And she looked across ledges and parapets to the old skyscraper with the massed midsection and the sunburst paneling, 10 blocks north, and thought how wonderful it was. What an accidental marvel to come upon a memory floating at the level of glazed mosaic high on a midtown tower. The old spoked sun that brings you luck. Chapter 2. The poets of the old nations of the basin told stories about the wind. Matt Shea sat in his cubbyhole in a concrete space about the size of a basketball court, somewhere under the gypsum hills of southern New Mexico. This operation was called the Pocket. There were people here who weren't sure whether they were doing weapons work. They were involved in exploratory research and didn't know exactly what happened to their findings, their simulations, the results they discovered or predicted. This is one of the underlying themes of the systems business, where all the work connects at levels and geographic points far removed from the desk toil and lab projects of the researchers. Matt used to do consequence analysis, figuring out the lurid mathematics of a nuclear accident or limited exchange. He worked with data from real events. There was the thing that fell to Earth on Albuquerque in 1957, a thermonuclear bomb of jumbo tonnage mistakenly released from a B-36. Nobody's perfect, okay? And landing in a field within the city limits. The conventional explosives detonated, the nuclear package didn't. The incident remained a secret to this day, 17 years later, as Matty sat in his cubicle reading a camping guide. He'd been in the Pocket for 5 months, and was definitely doing weapons work, but of the soft core type, involved with safing mechanisms mainly, his face pressed to a computer screen. He wasn't sure how he felt about this. He wanted to do weapons. He wanted the edge, the identity, the sense of honing his silhouette, knowing himself a little better. A secret installation in the desert. They named it the Pocket after a creature called the Pocket Gopher that lives in tunnels that frantically digs under the furrowed dunes. The dune fields, the alkali flats, the whiteness, the whole white sea-bottomed world, the lines of white haze in the distance, the 6,000-year-old mummified baby found in a cave near White City. Yes, and there were animals that bleached themselves white over the eons, a once-brown mouse that color-matched itself to the gypsum drifts to escape the gaze of predators. The wind blew out of the Oregon Mountains, busting up to 50 miles an hour, refiguring the dunes and turning the sky an odd, dangerous gray that seemed a type of white gone mad. And the men and women of the pocket, mainly men and mainly single, with only a small cluster of marrieds and their albino, was the joke, children. They lived in semi-attached bungalows at the edge of the missile range and listened to the wind that the sages of the old nations spoke about, evolving metaphors and philosophies, and it recrested the dunes, blowing steadily, sometimes for days. Do you work with sound waves? Do you gauge the effects of blast on delivery aircraft? Do you do physics packages and dream about a girl back in Georgia, the one who put her hand in your pants at the drive-in near the swamp? Do you long to see a fireball, an actual test shot? They're outlawed, of course, by now, atmospheric blasts, but you wish you'd seen one of the monster shots that vapored an atoll way back when. He ate lunch in the underground mess with Eric Deming, a tall, shuffly man in his early 30s, a couple of years younger than Matt, and one of the bomb heads. There was a droop to Eric's shoulders and clothes. He tended to eat with his hands. French fries, sure, but also lettuce, beets, boiled rice, corn niblets, anything he could pincer and lift in units. When's Janet coming? Soon. We're working out the details, Matt said. Will you show her to us? We haven't seen a woman from the outside world. You're in Alamogordo all the time. That's not outside. You have to go 1,000 miles before you're outside. You know that. In this state, Matty? She's not coming here. Okay, but in this state, do you know the percentage of people who have security clearance? Isn't that why we love it? We're meeting somewhere west of here, and then we're going camping. Remote, remote, remote. If I can talk her into it. She's not eager to do this, Janet. Eric worked in a lab area that Matt wasn't cleared to enter. He used to work with radioactive materials inside a sealed glove box. He wore protective gloves. He wore overgloves attached to his sleeves. He wore layers of treated clothing equipped with a number of film badges and rad detectors, and he worked with bomb components. The neutron initiator, the detonators, the subcritical pieces, the visceral heat inside the warhead. He was doing something else now, and Matt didn't know what it was. He wore a Q badge with yellow edges and spread astounding rumors. The bombheads loved their work, but weren't necessarily pro-bomb, walking around with Megadeth hard-ons. They were detail freaks. They were awed by the inner music of bomb technology. Matt watched them. He went to their parties and learned their language. They carried an afterglow of 60s incandescence, a readiness to give themselves compulsively to something. They thought he was angling for a transfer in, ready to become one of them, wear the coded badge, the Q-sensitive access that would get him through the last gate and into the tunnel that led to bomb design. But Matty was sneaking looks at outdoor magazines, at camp bags and dome tents, because he needed time to get away and think. He had doubts about the rightness of his role. Down Route 70 a ways, near the sign for the missile range, an area that is white on your map, this is where the protesters stood. 7 or 8 men and women, sometimes only 2 or 3. And they carried a sign stretched between wooden uprights, World War III starts here. And base personnel taunted them, or just smirked, or were flattered by the sign, or felt sorry for the sign carriers because they were windswept and unattractive. Matt liked seeing them. He counted on it, in a way. It began to be important to him, knowing they were there, 4, 5, 6 people, usually women outnumbering men, or maybe 2 grim figures clinging to the uprights, never saying a word as military vehicles passed, or flatbed trucks with draped objects, or civilian workers and construction crews, the odd finger flipped their way. The white places on your map include the air base, the army base, the missile range, the vast stretch to the northwest called the Jornada del Muerto,
and the interdunal flats as well. The flats were map white on the page and in living fact. And a few low buildings were situated here, fenced structures with propane tanks to service the underground operation in the pocket where weapons were conceived and designed. They worked to strict deadlines. There were always deadlines to meet. The bomb heads complained about this. They were the people of superior sensibility, the ones who'd gained a rational mastery over themselves, who weren't subject to moral ambivalence, to the sentimental baby shit of consequence and anguish. They were the ones who understood the hard-ass principles of the conflict, and they didn't like bureaucratic pressures exerted from the surface. But the deadlines persisted. There were deadlines all the time. There was the urgency of war without a war. Eric said, "You hear the latest secret?" They were walking beyond the bungalows at sunset, totally alone on the sand plain, and Eric kept looking around for eavesdroppers. Comically, of course, and he affected a side-of-mouth murmur that might frustrate even a lip-reader recruited to study surveillance tapes. "It's an old thing just now surfacing," he said, "in the form of very faint rumors." "What old thing?" "Workers at the Nevada test site in the days of above-ground shots." "What about them?" "And people living downwind. These people have a name, incidentally, that totally defines their existence."
"What is it?"
"Downwinders," Eric said. They ambled out past low growths of salt bush toward the electrified fence.
"What about them?" Matt said.
"Nobody's supposed to know this. It's something that's more or less out in the open, but at the same time..."
"What?"
"Secret, untalked about, hushed up."
"What's the secret?" Matt said.
"Multiple myelomas, kidney failures. Or you wake up one morning and you're 3 inches shorter."
"You mean exposure to fallout?"
"Or you start throwing up one day, and you throw up every succeeding day for 7-8 weeks.
"But isn't this something we have to expect? Occasional miscalculations? It's dangerous work, you know."
Eric seemed to enjoy this remark. No, he seemed to expect it. He seemed to find it encouraging. They walked out past a large, parabolic dune, and it was so draggingly hot out here that the air seemed a form of physical hindrance.
"Little farm communities, downwind of the tests. Nearly all the kids wear wigs," Eric whispered.
"Doing chemo?"
"Yeah. And here and there a kid that's born with a missing limb or whatnot. And a healthy woman that goes to wash her hair, and it all comes out in her hands. She's a ravishing, you know, brunette, 1 minute, and totally bald the next."
"Where?"
"Mainly southern Utah, I hear, because it's downwind. But other places, too. Adenocarcinomas. Old Testament outbreaks of great red boils. Great big splotches and rashes, and coughing up handfuls of blood. You look in your cupped hands, and you see a pint of ratted blood."
They walked along the electrified fence past a warning sign graffitied by a protester or some apostate working slyly in the pocket.
"You think the stories are true?"
"No,"
Eric said.
"Then why do you spread them?"
"For the tone, of course.
For the edge. For the edge. The bite. The existential burn."
Matty was 6 years old when his father went out for cigarettes. 8 days later, when his father hadn't come back and hadn't called or sent a message through a friend, the boy took all the change he could find in the apartment and started walking. He'd never gone alone past the 3rd Avenue L in this particular direction, but that's where he walked. Then he crossed the avenue where the trains ran through the long corridor below street level from the suburbs all the way down to Grand Central Station. That Nikki would one day throw rocks at. That Nikki would stand at the railing in plain sight throwing rocks at the trains running right below him. Then he climbed the long set of steps up to the streets near the concourse. He'd climbed these steps with his mother to go to the movies and get a sundae at the ice cream parlor nearby. And now he climbed the steps alone,
going to the Grand Concourse, where the movie theater stood, the Lowe's Paradise. And there were 60 or 70 steps and buildings on iron stilts, like another country altogether. He sees himself from this distance, in the white sands, standing across the street, looking at the great Italianate facade of the paradise. He sees himself staring up at the clock and the roof balustrade and the ornate stone cupola. He sees himself buying a ticket, barely able to reach the window hole, and he pushed the coins through the hole and watched the ticket woman hit a thing that sent the ticket out of a slit. He walked into the lobby. He felt an enveloping sort of warmth rise from the thick carpet like the happy repose of a stroked dog. There were goldfish swimming in marble basins. He looked at the etched glass chandeliers. There were a number of jutting balconies where paintings hung in gilded frames. He thought this was 1,000 times more holy than church. He is sitting in his half-bungalow near the missile range, and he sees himself climb the carpeted staircase because he wanted to sit high up, close to the theater ceiling. He saw the usher standing with a flashlight held across his belt. The usher wore braiding on his shoulders and a row of brass buttons set aslant his chest, and he flashed the light repeatedly, on and off, just to hear it click. Matty thought the usher would tell him he couldn't sit in the balcony because it was grown-ups only here, for smoking, or boys and girls who want to neck. But the usher clicked the thing and stood there, and Matty walked right by. He climbed to seats near the ceiling where stars twinkled and moved. The whole sky moved across the ceiling, stars and constellations and misty blue clouds. His mother wanted him to be an altar boy when he was old enough, but this was more tremendous than church. He sees all this as a grown-up who has never smoked a cigarette, who barely drives a car, and no longer plays chess, and loves a woman who's a nurse in Boston. He sees himself sitting in the balcony at the Paradise. The light from the movie glowed or faded, depending on the nature of the scene. He looked at the wall nearest him, and then at the other wall. And when the light flared and leaped, there it all was, the whole tremendous thing. Arches, porticos, statues, the urns, and marble busts. The vines trained through balusters, the pedestaled heroes with long swords, the columns in the shape of draped figures. Both walls crowded with stacked anatomies and structures, too much to take in, and angels that stood haloed atop the pediments. And he sat there and waited for his father, for the ghost or soul of his father to make a visitation. He took off his glasses, he put on his glasses. Then he took them off and wiped them with a pale cloth and sat in front of his screen, blinking at a display of data that pertained to an arming system, to that element of the weapon designed to send signals that will arm or safe or resafe the firing system. He heard a faint boom somewhere over the desert, the blast wave of Mach speeds, and it thrilled him, moved him. It always did, no matter how often he heard it or how far he was situated from the source. The sound woke him some mornings when the planes flew right over, and sometimes he stood outside his quarters before nightfall and watched the matched contrails of half a dozen aircraft in tight formation, the planes themselves long gone. But it was the drag and sonic shock. This is what awed and moved him. And then the afterclap rolling off the mountains, like they were blowing out a seam in the world. There were people here who didn't know where their work ended up, how it might be applied. They didn't know how their arrays of numbers and symbols might enter nature. It could conceivably happen in a flash. Everything connected at some undisclosed point down the system's line. This caused a certain select disquiet. But it was a splendid mystery, in a way, a source of wonder. How a brief equation that you tentatively enter on your screen might alter the course of many lives, might cause the blood to rush through the body of a woman on a tram many thousands of miles away. And how do you define this kind of relationship?
This ends Disc 13.